model parameters. So there would be some conditional probability distribution saying how the probability of getting data D depends on model parameters theta. And there are two main schools of thought in statistics. One is, and I did an example of the biased coin where there's just one parameter, the probability of heads, but I'll do a multi-parameter example in a minute. There's two main schools of thought in statistics. There's our frequentist methods. And the way those work conceptually is that I figure out for each point in the parameter space how to compute the p-value, which is the probability of a simulation with model parameters theta. Producing a result as extreme as the real data. And confidence regions are based on thresholding this p-value. So a frequentist confidence region can all...
Could you write a bit bigger?
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Thank you.
A frequentist confidence region can always be... is always computed by thresholding p in the theta space. So it can always be interpreted as the subset of the theta space in which the data would have a reasonable probability of occurrence. And then there are Bayesian methods, where the philosophy is to describe, the philosophy is to update a probability distribution on the theta space when you observe the data. So you start with I described it as a four-step process. You start by choosing a prior p. As far as I can tell, the word likelihood in statistics is just a synonym for a probability distribution, but it seems to be used more often in the Bayesian context. So you could either say prior likelihood or prior probability distribution. Some distribution p of theta on the model space, which represents your prior degree of belief, relative degree of belief among different models before you take the data. And that's a choice. And hopefully the results at the end don't depend strongly on the choice. That is one issue with Bayesian analysis. It's dependence on the prior. And then you compute the conditional probability or the conditional likelihood. The probability of getting the data if we hypothesize some set of model parameters. And then three, you compute the posterior likelihood using Bayes' theorem. So this is a probability distribution on D. It would be normalized so that, that's right, PDF on D. It would be normalized so that its integral over all values of D is equal to 1. And then you update the prior to the posterior using Bayes' theorem. Which just says that you multiply the prior by the conditional likelihood of getting the data that was actually observed, and then normalize to a probability distribution. I wrote d to the n theta here since the model parameters might, space might have multiple parameters. And then finally, you just interpret that likelihood. Compute confidence regions or interpret somehow the booster. Let me work through the example of the bias coin in these two frames. By the way, when I put up the example of the biased coin, I started by asking, if you were to observe 70 heads in 100 flips, and you, what calculation would you do to rule out the coin being fair? And someone had, I'm sorry, what's your name? I don't know anyone. Jessica, okay, don't know anyone's name yet. Jessica had said, figure out how many sigmas away it is. And so I just want to say that that actually is the best practical answer. That is what I would do as a practitioner of statistics. And strictly speaking, what you're doing there is you're approximating the conditional likelihood of getting a given number of heads as a function of theta as a Gaussian. And that approximation is OK because there are 100 coin flips and the central limit theorem applies. If you did that, you could see that for this distribution, the variance is the number of coin flips over 4. That's a standard result that you can either look up in statistics textbooks or it's easy enough to compute. And so the width of the curve here would be the square root of the variance, which is the square root of 25 or 5. And so you can see, doing essentially no calculation, that the original value of 0.7 was a 4 sigma fluctuation, and therefore very unlikely. So this question had more than one correct answer. I was just wanted to do it in a way which separated the issue of whether the Gaussian approximation was valid from the question of how frequentist and Bayesian statistics work conceptually. OK. In all the examples that I'm going to talk about in the class, either of these frameworks would work fine. But for the sake of avoiding having to do everything twice, I'm going to choose Bayesian. And from now on, I'm going to do all of the statistics in a Bayesian way. All right. So I'd like to do one more toy example before I start talking about cosmology, since I want to do an example with multiple parameters. And this will also motivate the definition of the Fisher matrix that I'm going to give next. And the second toy example is curve fitting. So a really standard setup is that you have some points with error bars in the xy plane. And you want to find the best fit straight line. So the let's say we have n points x, I, n, I with Gaussian error bars. And we want the best fit line. Default, error bars are often assumed to be Gaussian random variables. That's not always the case, but it's a good approximation when your statistical error is the sum of many uncorrelated contributions by the central limit theorem. So in this example, the model parameters would be a two-component vector. And the data would be the values y1 through yn. By the way, I'm only calling the data the part of the data that's random. So the x's and the sigmas I'm just taking to be part of the setup, and the y's I'm taking to be the d in this general framework. So I want to do this problem using Bayesian statistics. So step one is to choose the prior. And for lack of any better choice, I'm just going to choose the uniform prior. Now, this is not a normalizable prior. I didn't specify any range on the parameters a and b. But that's so that the integral would diverge. But that's generally OK in Bayesian analysis, as long as the posterior that you end up with turns out to be a normalizable probability distribution. The constant would drop out anyway. If I rescaled this p by an overall constant, then it just ends up in both the numerator. Rescaled the prior, it ends up in both the numerator and the denominator here, and it cancels. So you could imagine just taking some gigantic range on all of the parameters to cut off the integral and make it finite. So you could put some finite constant, and then it would just cancel in the end anyway. Step two is to, oh yeah, I forgot. A little thing that I was going to emphasize is that when I was explaining Bayesian statistics, I was just explaining that the conditional likelihood is a PDF on the data D, but the posterior likelihood is a PDF, a probability distribution on the model space theta. And in fact, they're the same function of D of theta. If the prior were one anyway, that would be true. Otherwise, you'd multiply in the prior, aside from a different normalizing constant. So Bayesian statistics more or less amounts to writing down this conditional likelihood, which is a PDF on the data space, and then just reinterpreting whatever you wrote down as a PDF on the model space. OK. So step two is to compute the conditional likelihood of getting the y's given some tables. And the assumption here is that the points really are described by a linear fit within their error bars. So that if the thetas were correct, if they were the true parameters of the linear fit that described the data, then the y's would be ax plus b plus a Gaussian error. It'll be convenient to actually write everything in a two-component vector notation. So I'm going to write this as the sum of theta a times a function f sub a, where f sub a is a two-component vector of functions that are just being multiplied by the parameters a and b. And the answer actually ends up being more readable this way, more compact this way. And this also has the advantage that everything that I write will generalize to a linear fit with many coefficients. For example, if this were a quadratic fit or an nth order polynomial fit, this would all still work, but with larger matrices and vectors. OK. So if this is how we're modeling the y's, then the probability of a given set of y's, the conditional probability, assuming that some given theta values are the truth, would be obtained by just considering the quantity y minus this sum. That would be Gaussian distributed. And so its PDF would just be given by the usual Gaussian distribution. So for each, if there was just one point, the likelihood would look like this. And with n points with error bars, since the statistical errors are assumed independent, I just multiply the individual likelihoods. So this would be the probability of forgiven. Oh, I forgot to write the thetas. Should have been a theta. Okay. So this would be the likelihood that given a particular set of thetas, if you assume those thetas are the truth, that a particular set of y's would arise as a statistical fluctuation. I'm just calculating what the Gaussian error residual would need to be and plugging that residual into the Gaussian likelihood function. Now, the next step, I'm going to compute the posterior. Now here, I'm going to drop an overall constant. Since the posterior is going to need to be renormalized anyway, according to Bayes' theorem. Basically the same thing, except that I'm now viewing it as a function of the thetas and thinking about that as a probability distribution. So then I'm going to multiply this out. Now, in this context, it's okay to, you know, for notational consistency, I'm going to write this d as y. I was writing the data as y before, so I'll continue to do that. Now, in this step, it's okay to drop this term. Since I'm not keeping track of the overall normalization, and this term is constant in theta. So here, where I'm thinking about this as a function of the thetas, you know, this term is treated as a constant. But it would not be OK to drop it here, where I'm thinking of it as a function of the y's. You know, conversely, a term like this, which depends on theta but not y, is definitely not OK to drop here, where I'm really interested in the theta dependence. But for purposes of understanding of this conditional PDF, where it's PDF on the y's, you know, this would just be an overall constant that you could take up. OK, and then let me write that as.
Do I have a question?
Oh, I'm sorry, you know, I meant to write, since I was writing the sum over I here, I shouldn't have had that product in front.
Why there is no yi in the second term?
Oh, yes, thank you.
And so maybe the two will cancel.
Oh, you're right. We should have had a yi. This should not have had the factor of two. Thanks. Okay. I'll write the result this way, where the matrix F is defined like this. and the matrix V, defined like this. And then step four is usually just interpreting or the posterior or doing something with it. And this posterior is straightforward to interpret since it is a multivariate Gaussian. There's one little step here, which is that to make it look exactly the same as the multivariate Gaussian that I wrote before, you would want to complete the square, so you'd want to write it as this one half theta minus f inverse v transpose f. There's a term here. When I complete the square, I would get this term, but this doesn't depend on theta, so I can drop it since I'm not keeping track of the overall normalization anyway. So this is a multivariate Gaussian. With mean. If you compare this to the expression for the multivariate Gaussian, the was written down before or is in the notes, then the mean is f inverse v. And covariance matrix c equals f inverse. And so it has the following interpretation. The best fit parameters, the a and the b that describe the data the best, are given by this, where f and v are a matrix and the vector that you compute from the data. And the errors on those parameters are given. So there would be some best fit point, theta bar, in the AB plane. And then there would be some covariance matrix that describes the errors on those parameters. And that's a matrix that can have an off-diagonal correlation. So there would be some error ellipse that you can draw. And this is a really standard thing that you can find in statistics textbooks. For example, in a data analysis package, there's probably a button you can press to fit a line through some points with error bars. And what that button is doing is computing these matrices and giving you these best fit parameters. And if you ask it for the errors on those parameters, it will give you this covariance. Yeah, I realize there's one. It's almost too minor to be worth mentioning. But one thing I realized that I forgot to mention is that I showed a lot of examples of a covariance matrix and an associated error ellipse. And I sort of drew how they were related, this the extent of the ellipse is given by the square roots of the variances or diagonal elements of the covariance matrix. And the correlation coefficient in the covariance matrix is telling you something about the slope here. This would be a negative correlation. I didn't say how you would actually draw the precise ellipse if you needed to. So just for the record, the way that you draw the ellipse is if you have a covariance matrix C, and that in this example, what you would do is you take the inverse covariance matrix and then in this example, the parameters in the plane are theta 1, theta 2. So theta here is the vector theta 1, theta 2. You would just threshold this function of theta. If you ever need to plot an error ellipse or an error ellipsoid in n dimensions, then you do it by inverting the covariance matrix, taking this quadratic function of theta and just thresholding it at some threshold value. Depending on which threshold value you choose, you can get the 1 sigma error ellipse, the 2 sigma error ellipse, and so on. And the reason that is true is that, generally speaking, you can find error contours by thresholding the PDF. And the PDF for a Gaussian likelihood, it's the inverse covariance matrix which appears. Thresholding this PDF at some probability would be equivalent to thresholding this quadratic function at some threshold value. Okay. So the matrix F, which appeared here, which described the covariance or the shape of the allowed region in the model parameter space, is a special case of something called a Fisher matrix that I want to define more generally. Raise these boards. I want to go back to this abstract setup where I have some model parameter space and some data, which is determined by a conditional likelihood function. And generally speaking, when we do statistics work, we're usually interested in one of the following three situations. Simulation, which is given a model theta, how do I make a random realization of D? Or more formally, draw a sample from the conditional likelihood. Or analysis, which is what we've been doing in all of the examples, which is given a D, a realization of the data, determine which theta values are allowed. For example, if we're analyzing the results of an experiment. And there's also forecasting, which is like analyzing the expected constraints from an experiment that you haven't done yet. So with no realization of D, the question we're trying to answer is, what are typical constraints on theta? With no realization of D provided, but generally in forecasting, we always have a rough idea of what model is plausible, or some rough starting guess for the model. So forecasting generally does require a choice of fiducial model. Depends on choice of fiducial model. Most papers in statistical cosmology are doing one of these three things. And so far, we've mostly talked about analysis. But the Fisher matrix, which I want to talk about next, is a tool for forecasting. So I'm going to define the Fisher matrix abstractly, and it's a bit hard to motivate the definition at first. So I'm going to slowly motivate it through the context in the context of examples. So the Fisher matrix is given a point theta in the parameter space, the fiducial model. The Fisher matrix is some matrix FAB, which is defined at this point, where the A and B are indices in the parameter space. And the definition is you take a the matrix of second derivatives of the conditional likelihood, and then take its expectation value over random realizations of the data. So even if, in forecasting, I'm not given a preferred realization of the data, I can still take the conditional likelihood of the data as a function of d and theta, take these derivatives, and then take the average over all realizations of the data that might occur. So as a simple example, I'm going to show that in this curve fitting situation, the Fisher matrix defined generally by this formula agrees with the specific matrix F that came up in the calculation. So there, the So back to the curve fitting example, the conditional likelihood was this. And the abstract definition of the Fisher matrix is this. Log this. The next step, I'll evaluate the derivatives inside the expectation value. It gives, most of the terms cancel, like this term is constant in theta. Only the quadratic term in theta survives. And I get this. Now the only step remaining is the expectation value over the data y, which normally would be a non-trivial step. But here, what's inside the expectation value turns out not to depend on y. So the answer is just there's minus signs that cancel, and the average is, which is what we found before. In this example, the Fisher matrix had an interpretation as the inverse covariance matrix of the constraints in the theta 1, theta 2 plane. And that matrix, in this example, that matrix didn't depend on the data realization y. The best fit point does, but the errors that you get do not. So they would make sense. This error ellipse would make sense in a forecasting context where I don't have an actual realization of the data yet. I want to interpret, in general, the Fisher matrix defined for any model by this equation as forecasting the expected inverse covariance matrix on the model space. I'll try to explain where this definition comes from, give some sort of a derivation for it. But as sort of a hand-wavy derivation, you might think about it like this, that if the posterior likelihood were Gaussian, then if it were of this form, then by taking the log to get rid of the x, and then by taking the matrix of second derivatives, this for the PDF, then the matrix of second derivatives would give you the inverse covariance. So this is some measure of the curvature of the likelihood function near the peak. This matrix of second derivatives gives you the width of the likelihood function near the peak, and which corresponds to the level of constraints. Now, if you were doing data analysis, you'd have a realization of the data to put here. But in forecasting, you don't. And so the only way to remove the dependence, without the expectation value, this would depend on D. The only way to remove that dependence is to take an expectation value over D. That's a hand-wavy non-rigorous justification. The Fisher matrix does depend on the, generally, on the choice of fiducial model. It didn't in this example, but in general, it will depend on the choice of fiducial model, theta fid. That would enter, for example, when you take this expectation value over D. That's understood to be an expectation value over random realizations of D in the fiducial model. But the dependence in practice is often a weak dependence. OK. So now I want to take this Bayesian statistics machinery and this abstract definition of the Fisher matrix and apply it in a CMB context. But first, I realized there were some things I forgot to tell you about random fields on the sphere. In hindsight, the ordering would have been better if I had done this in the random fields part and not in the statistics part. But there's a little gap I need to fill in, which is that so far when we've been talking about random fields, we've been talking about Euclidean random fields. Let's just consider the 2D case. So I want to temporarily change topics and then come back. A random field like the CMB is a 2D random field defined on the sphere. And so the CMB temperature would be a spherical function t of n, where n is a unit 3 vector. That's going to be my notation for spherical functions. And I showed CMB power spectra and maps of the CMB, but all of our machinery for talking about power spectra and random fields was done in the Euclidean case, where random field is a function of two variables, x and y. So I just want to explain precisely how random fields on the sphere work. It's morally similar, but the details are different because instead of plane waves in the Fourier expansion, you use spherical harmonics. So to compare, I'm going to make a table which sort of a dictionary between properties of a Euclidean 2D field phi of x, where x is a two-component vector, and a spherical 2D field phi of n, where n is a unit 3 vector. So first, the analog of the Fourier transform for a Euclidean field. Now I'm going to. I'm not going to talk about this in a huge amount of detail because I don't really need to use the details. It's really just the counting of modes that's going to matter for now. For Euclidean 2D field, we went back and forth between real space and harmonic space, Fourier space all the time. And this is the Fourier transform for Euclidean 2D field that says that an arbitrary real space field phi may be built up as a linear combination of plane waves. And the analogous statement on the sphere is that any real space function phi is a sum of spherical harmonics. Let me remind you that the spherical harmonic YLM is a special function which is defined for integer values of L, which an integer value of L, which must be non-negative, and an integer value of M, which must be between minus L and L. So for every L, there are two L plus one spherical harmonics. And the index L is, you should think of as the overall multipole of the spherical harmonic, or its total angular momentum. So L equals zero is a mode that's constant on the sphere. The Y00 is a constant function. Spherical harmonics of the form Y1m are the three dipole modes. Y2m are the three quadrupole modes, and so on. And the moral equivalence of in the Euclidean case, the Fourier representation of a field is some function phi of L. In the spherical case, we think of this series of coefficients as being the Fourier representation corresponding to the real space representation phi. As an aside here, which I think is sort of fun, generally speaking, so this is the analog of the Fourier transform for on the sphere. Generally speaking, in different contexts where a Fourier transform appears, the notion of compactness or boundedness and the notion of discreteness are exchanged. So in this case, if the real space domain is the sphere, that's a compact, non-discrete, this is the domain where the real space representation is defined. It's a compact, non-discrete space, continuous space. And over here in Fourier space, these coefficients ALM live on are defined on some set of integer pairs. So some, you could think of the Fourier domain as being some discrete lattice where the ALMs are arranged. And this is a non-compact, it goes out infinitely far to infinitely high L, but discrete space. Another way of saying it would be that it's the compactness here that is quantizing things over here. The L's are quantized integers rather than continuous numbers. And you know, for a simple example of this phenomenon, if you had a 1D function with periodic boundary conditions, then the compactness of the periodic boundary conditions means that the Fourier representation becomes a series. And so the Fourier representation is an infinite or non-compact but discrete space, the space of integers. And if I were to make it discrete over here, then this becomes a finite sum that becomes compact or bounded over here. I had no particular reason for bringing this up. I just think it's fun. So on the sphere, things are compact. And the Fourier representation is some sort of discrete sum rather than an integral representation. There's also the inverse transform. So in the to go the other way, in the Euclidean case, you would use the inverse Fourier transform. And the analog over here is that if I have phi and I want a formula for ALM, then what I can do is integrate Oh, I should have put n here just to make it consistent. And you can derive this from this by using the orthonormality of the spherical harmonics, the fact that if I integrate two spherical harmonics with a star, that's either 0 or 1, depending on whether the L's and the M's are the same. So this is this pair of equations defines a transform that goes between the real and harmonic space representations in the spherical case, analogous to the Fourier transform. And there are even numerical software packages that will do this for you. And in the CMB, we have to use them all the time, that you give you specify some sequence of coefficients, ALM, and it evaluates this sum for you and gives you the values of the field and some pixelization of this guy. So from the point of view of actually like writing code on the computer, there's not really much difference between working with Fourier series or working with spherical harmonic expansions. You just call a different function to go back and forth between real space and harmonic space. For 2D Euclidean fields, unless otherwise stated, I'm assuming that they satisfy translation and rotation invariance. So that's a three-parameter group of symmetries. Yes?
Question. For the discrete case, on the sphere, the y appears in both decompositions. So how do we, in practice, compute like the equivalent of the Fourier transform, so the ALM? How do we compute it in practice? Because we need the y, which is and to start it, which is a part of the decomposition.
The y is some, fixed.
Can deduce it from the function itself?
I didn't say it very clearly, but the y's are just some special functions that I'm not writing, that I'm not bothering to write down explicitly. The question of how they're efficiently computed is there's some recursion relation they have to evaluate. Okay. So every Euclidean statement has some spherical equivalent. There's some dictionary for going back and forth. The next thing in the dictionary I want to write down is how the correlation function and the power spectrum are defined. Let me continue this dictionary. So in the case of a 2D Euclidean field, I was assuming, unless stated otherwise, that the statistics are invariant under a three-parameter group of symmetries consisting of two translations and one rotation. For a spherical field, unless stated otherwise, I'll assume that the statistics are invariant under have full 3D rotational symmetry. So they have the three independent symmetries of a sphere, of a unit sphere. Okay. So two-point correlations in real space. Previously, we described them like this for a Euclidean 2D field, where the two-point correlation between two points by translation invariance only depends on the separation x minus y, and by rotation invariance only depends on the length of the separation. That's easy to see geometrically and doesn't really need a derivation. And the same is true in the spherical case. the two-point correlation function between two directions on the sky, it, in the presence of rotational symmetry, can only be a function of the angle between those directions. So this could be, symmetry allows this to be an arbitrary function of the angle between the two directions, which I'll denote theta and n prime. So that's a just to write a formula for that, it's the inverse cosine of the dot product of the unit three vectors. In both cases, this equation is really defining the correlation function. It's generally more convenient to describe two-point correlations in Fourier space, where the two-point function has some diagonalness to it. And here's where things get non-obvious. In the Euclidean case, there was a symmetry argument that showed that the two-point function of two Fourier modes has a 2D delta function in it. And the prefactor only depends on the length of L, not the direction of L. This defined the power spectrum. Symmetry is constraining the form of the right-hand side here, but it's not intuitively obvious like it is in real space. It required some calculation to see. And the same is true for the sphere. If I correlate two multipoles, then a full analysis shows that the two-point function is constrained by the symmetries. It has to have Kronecker deltas in L and M. So this is sort of similar to the 2D delta function here. And the prefactor depends on L, but not M. So that's similar to the power spectrum, depending on the length of L, but not its orientation. And this defines the power spectrum in the spherical case. So when you see plots of the power spectrum CL for the C and B, this is the definition. And this is not obvious or straightforward to derive. It requires some special function identities. I'm not really going to use properties of these spherical harmonics much in the class. I just want to make sure that I'm really stating how everything is defined. I decided not to wade into the special function mess and give the proof of this. I'm going to omit the proof. There's a similar statement in quantum mechanics called the Wigner-Eckhart theorem. So if you've seen how that's proved, then this statement is proved similar. One difference between the continuous case and the Euclidean case and the spherical case is that the power spectrum CL is only defined at integer values of L. So when you see the CMB power spectrum plotted, the L is quantized, in other words. It's plotted as a continuous curve, but strictly speaking, it's only defined at integer values. More things. It can be really non-obvious how to populate this dictionary. The spherical analog of a statement that might not be much calculation to derive in the Euclidean case can be really messy. And there's a lot of entries in the dictionary that I'm leaving out. But there's a few more that I'm going to use. Here's a statement. It was true in the Euclidean case. So phi is a real valued function in real space. Then the way that that property shows up in the Fourier transform is that the Fourier modes phi of L are still complex numbers because they're an integral with an e to the I in them. But the Fourier transform at wave numbers L and minus L are complex conjugates of each other. The analogous statement for a spherical field relates positive and negative M. And there's a sign here, minus 1 to the M. And I believe this sign is largely a matter of convention when defining the YLMs. It's a sign choice. This is, if I remember correctly, this equation is true with the physicist's definition of the YLMs, but there's a mathematician's convention that's different. Not 100% sure that's right, but I think that's right. So in particular, it's not something that you can prove straightforwardly. It depends on the details of sign choices made when defining the YLMs. But it comes from a special function identity. It is straightforward to derive if you have this special function identity in a list of properties of the YLMs somewhere. But deriving this is not straightforward. Anyway, all this means is that the negative m's are not independent of the positive m's. They're given by their complex conjugates with some sign. And that the m equals 0 mode is equal to its own complex conjugate, i.e. a real number. So in particular, at a given value of L, to fill in the harmonic space representation, fill in values of the ALMs, you need 2 L plus 1 numbers. 2 L plus 1 real numbers. At each L. The real part of AL0, the real part of AL1, the imaginary part of AL1, and the real and imaginary parts of the remaining multipoles. This is assuming that, again, that phi is real valued in real space. Like the CMB temperature is a real number. If phi were a complex valued field in real space, then this property wouldn't hold, and all of the values of m would be independent complex numbers in the Fourier representation. I just realized we're out of time. I got so excited talking about these ALMs, I lost track of the time. So I'll stop for today and keep going next time.